Our third case this morning is 2020-1189, 2020-1250, the State of Ohio versus LaDaisha Brooks for the appellant. Mr. Clark.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Some statutes are simply impossible to apply retroactively because all action they contemplate exists in the future. House Bill 228, which governs burdens of proof at the time of trial, is one such statute because it contemplates only future trials. This case is not about the limits on the retroactive application of statutes. Instead, it's about the plain language of this statute and applying that plain language prospectively to future trials. Notably, when the General Assembly revised the self-defense statute, it added the term at the trial to the statute. Prior to House Bill 228, that language was never included in the self-defense statute. So I want to go briefly through the language of the statute, talk about why the plain language compels prospective application, and then talk about why, even though prospective application may reach back to antecedent facts, that does not implicate a retroactivity analysis. If, at the time of trial, a person who is accused of an offense that involved the person's use of force against another, there is evidence presented that tends to support the accused person used force in self-defense, the prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused person did not use the force in self-defense. The statute talks about the accusation in the past tense. It does reach back to antecedent events, the time of the offense, to talk about the accused in the past tense, but then it shifts to the present tense to talk about the time of trial. And it says, at the time of trial, if there is evidence presented. The plain language, using basic rules of grammar, tell us that this statute looks to the time of trial. This is not the only kind of statute that the General Assembly has written that speaks about trial procedure. Chapter 2945 of the revised code, which governs trial procedure, speaks at depth about things that happen at the time of trial, procedural rules that happen during a prosecution. And this is just one of those things. Notably, if the General Assembly did want this to be an offense-based statute, it could have made the statute focused on the offense. It could have said, if for all offenses or indicted conduct done on or after X effective date, and then turned self-defense into an offense-based statute. But it didn't. Instead, it specifically added the phrase at the trial to the statute. And this is in sharp contrast to the way that this statute has been handled in the past. The state cited the State versus Adkins, a third district case that cites State versus Gall, to say that the offense is the time that matters. But State versus Gall was interpreting a prior version of the statute that had uncodified language in 134 Ohio Laws 2034 that specifically said the effective date of the statute applies only to offenses committed on or after a date.
Couldn't the legislature have done that, as we acknowledged in White?
The legislature
picked a date?
The legislator could have picked a date, yes, but they
and
didn't.
They didn't. They didn't say anything, right?
And they didn't need to. They added the phrase at the time of trial to the statute, and that tells us that we're going to prospectively apply this rule at the time of trial.
At the time of trial, as you said, the facts of the case, it speaks in the past tense.
It does.
So if you have a past event, and then you have at the time of trial, that's now.
Yes. And at the time of trial is telling us, here are the rules that we apply at the time of trial. And the rule for self-defense that we apply at the time of trial is that the state has the burden of proof. And this is consistent with this court's precedent, with Supreme Court of the United States precedent, and with the precedent of lower appellate courts. I want to direct this court to State versus Pitts, a first district case that goes through the analysis of why, even though we might reach back in time to antecedent facts, we need not apply a retroactivity analysis. And what Pitts says is that just because an offense may have been committed before the law changed does not automatically make House Bill 228 a retroactive law. Because a court, in deciding whether there's retroactive application, must ask whether the new provision attaches a new legal consequence to events completed before its enactment. And this law does not do that. If we look to self-defense, defense of another, or defense of property, the three types of affirmative defense contemplated in House Bill 228, each and every one of those things was permissible before this law was enacted. All that House Bill 228 does is tell us what the procedural burdens of proof are at the time of trial. A person who acted in self-defense before the enactment of this statute acted legally. They just bore the burden of proving it. A person who acted in self-defense after the enactment of this statute had to meet the same elements, had to act in the same way, but all we've done is shift that burden of proof to the state. And
counsel, some of the districts interpret that at the time of trial, a person who is accused means that it is incumbent upon, at that time is when that has to be introduced at trial. It's a temporal reference saying that this is when you bring it up at the time of trial.
Affirmative defenses are generally raised at the time of trial. That would make this language surplusage, and this court should not read the statute to include surplus language. There are a variety of affirmative defenses that may be brought up at the time of trial. In a prior version of this statute, self-defense was raised at the time of trial. The General Assembly then added that language and then made present tense verbs discuss what is done at the time of trial.
Well, actually, it doesn't say at the time
of trial.
If at the trial, a person who is accused. So it really is, if you take away the word time, which, you know, you're saying, if at the trial a person is accused of an offense that involves the person's use of force, they're saying if that happens, here's the consequence. Here's what you have to prove.
Yes.
So I'm not so sure at the trial is meaningful.
The fact that it was added specifically to the statute by the General Assembly and it did not exist in the prior version of the self-defense statute makes it meaningful, especially when it's combined together with the present tense language saying at future trials.
Where
this is
else would you assert this, if not at the trial? Where else would that be tested, if not at the trial? It is surplus as far as the way I'm reading it. You don't argue your case in a pretrial. You could, but this is talking about the actual burden of proof, and that's all it is just saying the burden of proof shifts.
And it's a procedural change that occurs at future trials after the effective date of the statute, which is why its prospective application occurs at all trials after the effective date of the enactment. I want to draw a comparison to two cases from the Supreme Court of Florida, which I think might be instructive on this. The state cited Smiley versus State for the argument that this would be a retroactive law if we applied it backwards. What they did not point to is a second Florida Supreme Court Love versus State. And what Smiley was a case about actually changing the substantive law of self-defense. It eliminated a duty to retreat. And the Florida Supreme Court said, well, a person acting in time or in a past time would not have known about the elimination of the duty to retreat. So that changes the substantive nature of a self-defense claim. So we can't apply that retroactively. In contrast, Love versus State changed the burden of proof for proving self-defense. And the Florida Supreme Court said, you know, all we're changing now is a trial procedure. A person who acted in the past would have acted according to the same substantive law then as they would now. This is a procedural change, and there's no need to do a retroactive analysis. This court held similarly in EPI of Cleveland versus Limbach. EPI of Cleveland versus Limbach is a tax case from the 1980s. And the tax code changed in a variety of ways between the late 70s and the early 80s. If there was a vendor who wanted to contest the assessment of a tax in the 70s, they had three or four categories of evidence that they could use to attack the assessment of a tax. That changed over, I think, the course of three statutory amendments to all relevant evidence. So suddenly a vendor had a lot more evidence at their disposal to attack a tax. And this court said, we can apply the most recent statute even though the tax that was being attacked is from 1978, because this is simply a procedural rule impacting how the trial occurs.
So with that argument, you don't even need your textual argument about at the time of trial, right? That this is, you could also just say this is a procedural rule, so it applies at trial, it doesn't, it's not retroactive, there's no retroactive issue.
That's correct. I think there's the textual argument. We're just reading the plain language of the statute. And then there's the procedural argument. This governs procedure at future trials. And it governs procedure at future trials without changing the substantive law of self-defense. And that is the key here. Had self-defense changed, had we eliminated a duty, had we eliminated an element and made self-defense substantively different, I would not be making that argument today. But this is simply a procedural change to burdens of proof. And it's a procedural change that mattered here. Because LaDasia Brooks was required by the trial court to prove by a preponderance of evidence that she acted in self-defense. That is an error of constitutional dimension. It impacts her due process rights to a fair trial. The state is not able to show that that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, as is required by Chapman versus California, pardon me. And I had asked this court, if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Looking at the fact that the jury found her guilty of burglary, the state makes the argument that because she was a trespasser, she wasn't entitled to assert self-defense. So were we to agree with you and also to agree with the state on that point, would it be appropriate for us to then find accordingly and remand to the trial court to make the determination of whether or not she can even assert the defense of self-defense?
I think it would be appropriate to reverse and remand for a new trial, and here's why. The aggravated burglary and burglary charges for which Ms. Brooks was convicted had three potential predicates. Either theft, assault, or domestic violence. There was argument before closing arguments about actually eliminating the predicate of theft. The trial court decided not to do that.
I was talking about burglary, though.
Yes, but these are the predicates to the burglary. And it's unclear whether the jury found as a predicate that she intended to commit a theft, intended to commit assault, or intended to commit domestic violence. The assault and the domestic violence charges, which are nested into that burglary instruction, are the charges for which she got self-defense. Jurors are black boxes. We don't know how they deliberated to reach the burglary or aggravated burglary conviction. The only way that this could possibly be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is if the jury was instructed that theft was the predicate for the burglary or the aggravated burglary. The jury was not instructed that way. This can't be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Ms. Boyer.
Madam Chief Justice O'Connor and Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the court, my name is Olivia Boyer, and I represent the appellee, the state of Ohio, in this matter. excuse me. The state of Ohio is asking this court to hold that House Bill 228, as enacted by the General Assembly, is not retroactive in its application. And as such,
Counselor, if we find that retroactivity is not the analysis here, do we side with Ms. Brooks?
Your Honor, I would present to this court that retroactivity is the appropriate analysis. What this court, the question before this court is whether or not the legislation that shifts the burden of proof on self-defense to the prosecution apply to all subsequent trials, even when alleged offenses occurred prior to the effective date of that act. That's the issue before this court.
Well, if we take out the language of the statute that says at trial, if we take out that language, then substantively the language would still be the same. So what would be the purpose? I mean, the substantive analysis would be the same. So what would be the General Assembly's motivation for putting in at trial?
Your Honor, I would direct this court to the Fifth District Court of Appeals decision that brings us here today in State v. Brooks, where the Fifth District Court of Appeals correctly points out that the language of at the trial of puts the state on notice, puts the parties on notice, that it's at the trial where self-defense is to be addressed.
Well, but as the Chief Justice noted, where else would it be?
Good question. I would direct this court to the state of Florida, which was brought up by appellant. In the state of Florida, they actually have what they call an immunity hearing in Stand Your Ground when there's a question of whether or not immunity would apply to an offender if they acted in self-defense.
But we don't have that here.
We do not, Your Honor. What we have here is that at the trial of is the designation of when this is to be raised.
But in Ohio, there is no other place for it to be adjudicated.
Correct. But I believe the General Assembly, by putting that language in, is putting the parties on notice that it's to be raised at trial, and they're forfeiting the option to have it raised at a pretrial motion or even post-conviction. Even getting really creative, the General Assembly could have had this be a determination made after a Rule 29 motion or even post-conviction, but they're making it clear it's
okay,
at the trial.
But even if you're right about that, isn't this still a procedure rule that applies prospectively? There's no need to do any retroactivity analysis, right, if it's procedural?
Well, in order for there to be the question before the court in terms of retroactivity is it has to be clear that the General Assembly intended for this legislation
to
be applied.
That's not really true, right? If the General Assembly makes a procedural change and doesn't say anything, we apply that prospectively.
We don't even get
to that question of retroactivity.
If this court finds that it is a procedural change, Your Honor, but I would argue to this court that it is substantive. In looking at the analysis that this court undertook in Van Fossen, there's a question as to whether or not it's procedural or substantive, and there isn't a bright line test for the difference between what is procedural change and what is substantive.
Aren't allocations of burdens of proof generally understood as procedural, not substantive?
Yes, Your Honor, but what we have here is a change as to who the burden applies to. Previously, prior to the enactment.
Now that's allocation of the burden of proof, who it applies to.
But it creates a duty upon the state of Ohio to now bear that burden with regard to self-defense. Prior to the enactment of House Bill 228, it was the responsibility of the defendant by a preponderance of evidence to bring up the affirmative defense of self-defense. Now, House Bill 228 has changed that. It shifted the duty from defendant to the state.
But again, isn't shifting the duty is changing the allocation of the burden of proof. Hasn't that always been understood as a procedural change, not a substantive one?
Yes, Your Honor, but again, I would go back. It's creating a duty upon the state.
Well, that's any burden of proof, right? Any change in the burden of proof changes who the duty is on.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would direct this court to State v. Jones. In State v. Jones, this court previously ruled that such a change as comparable to what we're discussing here with House Bill 228 is substantive. There was a further analysis in State v. Webb, but Webb is distinguishable from Jones in this particular matter because the court ruled in Webb that statutory law is still limited by Article 2, Section 28 of the United States Constitution, that it's not retroactive. So in Jones, a prior change to self-defense, to the statute that we're here discussing, was a substantive change. That this is what the court has previously ruled. So I would direct the court to look at State v. Jones. Now, back to my first point, House Bill 228 is unambiguous and is as the General Assembly intended it to be. It is applied in light of existing jurisprudence and existing statutes. I would direct this court to Ohio Revised Code 1.47, where that statute states it is presumed the General Assembly enacts a statute that, one, complies with our Constitution, that the entire statute, two, is intended to be effective, and three, a just and reasonable result is intended. I would also direct this court to Ohio Revised Code Section 1.48. A statute is presumed to be prospective in its operation unless expressly made retroactive. And in looking at the text of House Bill 228, the only language that is cited to by appellant that implies, that they're arguing implies retroactivity, is at the trial of. I would ask this court to take a look at Senate Bill 256. This was enacted by the General Assembly and became effective in April 21st of 2021. That particular statute pertained to a juvenile who was tried as an adult, and in that legislation, the General Assembly prohibited a juvenile who's tried as an adult from being sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And in that legislation, the General Assembly included language and expressly stated, quote, regardless when the offense or offenses were committed and when the sentence was imposed. That's the type of language we need in House Bill 228 to demonstrate the General Assembly intent. Clearly, unambiguously, expressly demonstrates their intent that House Bill 226 was to be applied regardless when the offense or offenses were committed. And as Chief Justice O'Connor, as you point out, at the trial of doesn't really add anything to the statute. It doesn't add clearly that it needed to be applied retroactively. That's what we're talking about here. The General Assembly has demonstrated an ability and the knowledge that when it wants to make a statute retroactive, it can include clear and express language. Had such language as was included in Senate Bill 256, had language comparable to that been included in House Bill 228, I wouldn't have an argument. Because at that point, the General Assembly has put all parties on notice of its intent that it wanted House Bill 228, the changes to self-defense, to be applied retroactively.
But question for you over here. When we look at 2901.04B, which is the rule of lenity, and when we apply it to criminal procedure, in sections of the revised code regarding criminal procedure, it says they shall be construed to affect the fair, impartial, speedy, and ensure administration of justice. And I look at the other case law, and this is not a situation where the amendment creates a new crime or increases the burden or the punishment for a past crime. So when you say there's nothing in the revised code, I think maybe there is. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think we need to honor the intent of the General Assembly, and that if the General Assembly had wanted it to be retroactive, they could have included that specific language. But as to your
but
question...
But why then did they put this section in the code when there's any doubt we apply the rule of lenity?
I believe they included that language, as the Fifth District correctly points out, at the time and place. For when self-defense, it is at the trial that we are to address it. It's not a pretrial motion. It's not a post-conviction issue to be addressed. It's at the trial of. And again, referencing back to Florida, where they have a pretrial hearing on immunity, that could have been contemplated by the General Assembly.
But if you just look at this overall, the greater burden clearly is on the state.
Yes, Your Honor.
But isn't that what the revised code says needs to happen generally anyways?
While the state bears the burden now under House Bill 228 in addressing self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, I would point out that the other sections of the Ohio Revised Code 1.47, Ohio Revised Code 1.48, and Ohio Revised Code 1.5, those all address what the General Assembly needs to do with regard to making a statute retroactive. Ohio Revised Code Section 1.58, the enactment, amendment, or repeal of a statute does not, except where sentences are reduced, and that's, I believe, the question of lenity, affect the prior operation of the statute or any prior action taken there under. And the application of Ohio Revised Code 1.58 here means that just because House Bill 228 amended the statute regarding self-defense in this case does not make the prior version inoperable. It still applies. It can still be considered here.
But isn't the rule of lenity more specific than what you're reading to me from the general provisions of the code?
Your Honor, I would defer to the court on that. I don't know that that is something that is contemplated here, because we're talking about whether or not this particular statute's retroactive, whether or not the General Assembly, in changing the duty from defendant in addressing self-defense and shifting that to the state, I don't think that that's something that's contemplated here. Now, appellant did cite to Love v. Florida, in that the Florida Supreme Court ruled that the legislative change imposed on a state a lesser burden than would otherwise already be held at trial with respect to the same factual question, and the Florida court ruled that a change to the burden of proof the state had to address with regard to self-defense was procedural. However, I would cite again to State v. Jones, in which this court has already ruled that a change in the burden with regard to self-defense and modification to the self-defense statute is substantive. My final point I would present to this court is that even if this court, and I believe, Justice Bruner, you brought this up, that even if this court does rule that House Bill 228 is retroactive, appellant fails. It is well established within our jurisprudence that you cannot claim self-defense when you are responsible for the circumstances that then necessitate you act in self-defense. You do not get to throw the first punch in a fight and then claim self-defense. More appropriately here in this case, you cannot go to someone's house uninvited and then claim self-defense for the fight that ensues inside. Appellant concedes in page one of their brief, quote, when she, Miss Brooks, discovered Mr. Myers in bed with Miss Price, Miss Brooks began striking Miss Price. They are conceding that she started the fight. Upon finding the father of her child that they have in common, she started the fight when she found him in bed with another woman. The 10th District Court of Appeals in 2016 decision State v. Wilcox, citing this court and State v. Martin from 1986, stated that trespass presupposes fault in creating the situation that gave rise to the altercation and is therefore inconsistent with self-defense.
So I wanted to ask you in regard to that. Your colleague said that basically because there wasn't the predicate instruction on theft or even domestic violence, that somehow we consider the jury the black box and we don't know how they got to burglary, but they would have to have crossed that pathway to get to burglary, don't you think?
Yes, Your Honor. And there were multiple basis offenses that the jury could have considered in determining aggravated burglary. The facts at trial show there was photographic evidence presented at trial of Miss Brooks holding cash in her hand that the victim, Daniel Myers, testified she stole from him. That's theft. That is a sufficient prerequisite offense to support the conviction for aggravated burglary. There was also a domestic violence incident that took place where Miss Brooks, it was established at trial via the witnesses, Miss Brooks assaulted Daniel Myers, and Daniel Myers testified as to the nature of his injury. That offense is sufficient to have supported her conviction for aggravated burglary, coupled with the fact she entered the home without permission. Three witnesses testified at trial, Alicia Randolph, Jackie Randolph, and Daniel Myers, all testified at trial that LaDeja Brooks did not have permission to be in the home. She gave rise to the circumstances. I see that my time is almost up. I would ask this court to hold that House Bill 228 is not retroactive, as the General Assembly did not put within House Bill 228 clear language indicating it needed to be applied retroactively. I'd also ask this court to consider its analysis in Van Fossen, whether or not this is substantive or a procedural change. Our position, the state's position, is that this is a substantive change as it creates a new duty. And finally, Ms. Brooks is not entitled to self-defense as she gave rise to the circumstances that brought forth the case. Thank you.
Counselor, before you sit down, can I ask, you're saying she's not entitled to that defense, but does that doesn't necessarily have any bearing on our resolution, correct? If we were to find that the retroactivity is not appropriate here and that it is a procedural change that applies to her case, that wouldn't change whether or not she's entitled to the defense substantively, would it?
Your Honor, if that's the court's ruling in this particular case, I would ask that this court reverse and remand to the Fifth District Court of Appeals for analysis under harmless error.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you saved a minute.
I want to make 2 points briefly, one about retroactive analysis and two about prejudice. First, the General Assembly did not include retroactive language because that would have been unnecessary to implement a procedural rule. The comparison to Senate Bill 256 simply fails because 256 created a new substantive right to not be sentenced to life in prison without parole. That is a substantive change in the law, and therefore retroactive language was necessary to impose it backwards in time. By contrast, this is a burden of proof issue. The reliance on State versus Jones is completely misplaced for a couple reasons. First, Jones has been overruled by this court in Webb. Second, even if Jones hadn't been overruled, Jones was an ex post facto case because the Jones self-defense circumstances involved shifting the burden from the state where it had been onto the defendant. This is a shift in the other direction. What Webb says in a subsequent case is that that kind of burden shifting no longer implicates the ex post facto clause, citing to the United States Supreme Court in Youngblood versus Collins. So if Jones is all they have to lose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You're going to be notified of our decision. Thank you.